Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Hi, I'm Marcus Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Premier, which produces this podcast and many others. Like you, I love listening to these amazing podcasts. I also love hearing about the people who are impacted by them, like Sheila from Cheshire. Sheila's parents were both sick and she was going through a difficult time taking care of them. But she started listening to Premier's podcasts and God spoke to her through them with just the right thing she needed to hear at just the right moment. She felt reassured that God had it in hand and that her parents would be safe. It's incredible to know how important these podcasts are to so many, but they are listener funded, which means we need your support to keep them going for people like Sheila. This week, we come to the end of our financial year with our funding need yet to be met. Would you consider a donation today to help us reach more people like Sheila with hope and encouragement through our podcasts? Give your gift today at premier.plus/donate. That's premier.plus/donate. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. On the 25th of March, many people will be celebrating Tolkien Reading Day. For over 20 years, the Tolkien Society has been encouraging fans to celebrate and promote the life and works of J.R.R. Tolkien by reading their favourite passages on and around this date. And to mark this occasion, I am absolutely delighted to welcome Dr. Holly Ordway to the show to speak about J.R.R. Tolkien. Holly is the Cardinal Francis George Professor of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute and Visiting Professor of Apologetics at Houston Christian University. She's written numerous books and articles about various members of the Inklings, but our focus today is Holly's fantastic spiritual biography of J.R.R. Tolkien called Tolkien's Faith. Holly, thank you so much for joining us today. We have spoken about many aspects of Tolkien's faith in previous episodes, but we didn't get to talk about a significant topic, one which sadly impacted both J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis in significant ways, and that is suffering. Holly, how did Tolkien and Lewis come to such different conclusions about the existence of God after losing their mothers at such a young age?
Well, this is a really interesting question, and I'm glad you ask it because it helps to underscore the fact that, you know, Tolkien remained a sincere Catholic even through the death of his mother, but it was not by any means a foregone conclusion. It wasn't automatic because we can look at Lewis and say, well, Lewis lost his mother and he lost his faith along with that, and there is a mysterious element to it. The basic answer is we can't know because there's so many things going on in the interior lives of these two men. So it would be, in one sense, you know, presumptuous to say, well, this is exactly why. But I do think that looking at their circumstances, we can point out, I think, one major difference that probably had an influence. So Lewis, when his mother dies, his father's still alive. Tolkien had lost his father when he was little. So when his mother died, Tolkien was a complete orphan. But it's Lewis who's, in a way, more traumatized because his father then sends him off to a boarding school. And he's cut off from, in a sense, from a support network. And of course, the school he goes to is horrible. Whereas Tolkien, though left an orphan, is left under the care, the guardianship of Father Francis Morgan, who had been a friend of the family. His mother had chosen him to be her executor and the guardian of her boys. And Father Francis, as a priest of the Birmingham Oratory, is part of a whole community of men who kind of come on board, you know, to be a substitute family. So Father Francis becomes what Tolkien calls his second father. He has a real fatherly relationship with Father Francis, and he has kind of a support network of these other priests, some of them quite young, you know, kind of honorary uncles, you know, we've got. Whereas Lewis is very isolated. He has his brother Warney, but he doesn't have that nurturing environment. And he certainly doesn't have a nurturing spiritual environment. He goes to church with the school every now and then, but he's very kind of abstracted out of a context of really understanding what the faith is. So Tolkien has the advantage of a father figure who is really trying to help him come to grips with the death of his mother and doing it in the context of his faith. Now, that's no guarantee that Tolkien's going to keep on in his faith, because he might not have. But it meant that as he's growing up, he's able to bring his questions to Father Francis or to any of the other fathers that he had there, who would have been able to respond to him and help him work through these theological questions. Why did my mother die? You know, why didn't she, you know, why wasn't she healed? These are questions that Tolkien would have had a context to work through, whereas Lewis didn't. He only had the experience of having prayed so earnestly for his mother and not had his prayers answered. But who could he turn to for help with that? Really nobody. And I think that initial context doesn't explain their different reactions, but I think it certainly had a lot to do with their different responses.
Well, and let's talk about Tolkien's experience of the Great War, because that was clearly another moment of great, great suffering in his life. I mean, it was great suffering for everyone. 6% of the adult male population in Britain died through this tragic war. 2 million wounded. Lots of his own friends. I mean, he says, doesn't he, that by 1918, all but one of my closest friends were dead. I mean, what impact did the Great War have on Tolkien and Lewis's faith? Because that's another moment where Tolkien and Lewis had quite a different approach to their faiths because of the Great War, isn't it?
And I think this is a great question. And I think it helps us kind of squelch a very annoying misconception, the idea that there are no atheists in foxholes. Well, yes, there are. Yes, there are. And Lewis was one of them. Mm-hmm. Lewis had lost his faith by the time he was a soldier. And he says at one point, Lewis remarks that, you know, he was often horribly frightened, but he says, I never sank so low as to pray. And I think that's really helpful to recognize that there's not some sort of automatic piety that comes in the trenches. That was absolutely not the case. And a lot of the men who went into the war as Christians found their faith really shattered at the end of it. But Tolkien didn't. He went into the war as a sincere Catholic, and he came out of the war as a sincere Catholic. Not unaffected. We'll get to that in a moment. But he got through it. And this is such an interesting question. When I did my research for Tolkien's faith, I had the great good fortune to turn up two contemporary texts, both published in 1919. One of them commissioned by the Church of England, asking Anglican chaplains, how did the men get through the war? One of them commissioned by the Catholic Church in England, asking Catholic chaplains, how did your men get through the war? Mm. And so I was able to compare the firsthand accounts of the Anglican and the Catholic chaplains. So not a retrospective, you know, look at it, but this is like they were interviewing their own pastors in the front lines. And it was really interesting, the conclusions that they drew. The Anglican chaplains recognized that their men had not come through the war very well. And they themselves put the blame primarily on sort of a lack of foundations. That the men didn't know their faith very well. And so it was very easy for them to just, you know, let it go. And that has a lot to do with the fact that Anglicanism, you know, well, it's the state religion. So if you were not officially something else, you were Church of England. And so there's a huge number of people who sign up or who go into the war who are nominally Christian, you know, Church of England, but are just culturally Christian. They don't have any particular faith. And so that makes it really hard going for the sincere believers amongst the Anglicans, because they look around and maybe, you know, their compatriots might or might not have any shred of Christian belief, even though they're nominally Church of England. And that just makes it even harder for the sincere Anglicans. And then there's, of course, the great breadth of tradition within Anglicanism. You know, what would be comfort for one high church Anglican would be offensive to more of an evangelical Anglican. So it was just difficult for the Anglican pastors to even to be working in the field of chaplains. Catholics, on the other hand, it was not easy to be a Catholic in England at that time. You really only were a Catholic if you meant to be one. It was not something that you were by accident. It was not good for your social status or your economic status. So if you were a Catholic, you meant it. And that meant that, by and large, the Catholic soldiers were men who did go to church every Sunday. They did hear the sermons. They did have at least some rudimentary understanding of the faith. And that's what the Catholic chaplains reported, that the men, by and large, understood the basics of their faith, even if in various circumstances they weren't great at practicing it. It was more, they might have fallen out of the habit, but they knew the basics. And I think that meant that if you were Catholic also, you could look around, and if you saw another Catholic soldier, you could be pretty confident that you could say pray with that man. You could talk about your faith with that man. You wouldn't get brushed off because he probably really meant it. And that meant that it was partly harder, but partly easier to be a Catholic as a soldier. It was a very paradoxical kind of situation. But again, this is what the Catholic chaplains themselves recognized as they were interviewing the men and as they were interviewing the chaplains who would serve with the men. And one of the things that the Catholic chaplains explicitly called out as significant in the experience of the men is that they were not deeply troubled by the problem of evil, because they had already taken in, as part of their teaching as Catholics, the idea that evil is something that comes about because of free will, that men make bad choices, they choose to sin, they create this evil situation, and then we're left to deal with it. And so they were able to see the war as a horrific, tragic result of human sin, and not as, why is God doing this to us? And then they would also see that God's response is his crucified son. You know, that the suffering and death and resurrection of Jesus is the answer to the problem posed by this horrific creation of human sin. So the Catholic chaplains were able to say that their men just could face the suffering in a more grounded way than their Anglican compatriots did. And I think that's certainly the case with Tolkien, particularly since he had to face the problem of suffering already, in that he was an orphan. So he had already worked through this. He had kind of developed the spiritual muscle already. Like, yes, suffering is a thing that happens. No, I didn't deserve that my mother died. But in the mystery of God's providence, she did. And here I am carrying on. I think that same sort of spiritual muscle helped him get through what he saw of the trauma of the war.
And this is a brilliant line, just to throw in something slightly lighthearted in what's obviously a very heavy topic. There's a great line in your book where you quote an Anglican soldier who said, "The Church of Rome sent a man into action mentally and spiritually cleansed. The Church of England could only offer you a cigarette." That's quite an interesting comparison between the two chaplaincies.
And actually, that gets back to one of the difficulties faced by the Anglican chaplains, because as I noted, there's such a diversity of practice that for a high church Anglican, they might want their chaplain to hear their confession, because that's a thing that is a possibility in Anglicanism. But the idea of confession to a priest is offensive to more evangelical Anglicans. So what is the Church of England supposed to do? Because the chaplain doesn't necessarily know. Here's a wounded soldier. What does he say? Mm-hmm. So he can't just offer to hear his confession because that might be, really almost traumatizing. What are you, a papist? Right? But this is an era in which smoking was obviously much more widespread than now. So they're reduced to, well, what's the sort of lowest common denominator? What's the minimum thing that we can do that's going to be some comfort and not offend anybody? Well, we can offer them a cigarette and ask them if they have any messages for their family. And that was a sort of pastoral challenge that made it harder for the Anglican chaplains to operate. And it did lead to some bitterness and struggle for those Anglicans who wanted a more robust spiritual support. Mm-hmm. But of course, for Catholics, since there is the confession, absolution, last rites is part of what it means to be a Catholic, those chaplains could just go right in and offer, spiritual support, knowing that they had a framework in which it would be received.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've got a friend who's sceptical about Christianity? That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hand of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics, and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe, and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thank you to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures that content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Now on to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. And how did liturgy help Tolkien when it came to the problem of suffering and dealing with his own suffering?
Well, he was faced with a challenge that his worship life was just turned upside down because, they're moving around and, you couldn't get to mass or you couldn't plan on anything. So one of the things that he did was to commit to memory the central part of the liturgy of the mass, the canon of the mass, which is quite a long, stretch. He had a phenomenal memory. And so what he would do is he could mentally recite this passage of the section of the mass in which there's the Eucharist is offered up. There's the prayers, various prayers for the church and for others. And he could kind of then spiritually participate in this, even if he was just by himself, in the trenches. And that the memorization of prayers was an important part of his spiritual life. And, it would have helped him in many ways, but certainly during his time in the trenches, it allowed him a sort of a reserve of ways to pray when maybe he's tired, he's distracted, he's fearful. Extemporaneous prayer is a very good thing, and he did, but hassling to rely on words that are there just to turn to, I think was a great help to him. And he later does recommend memorizing prayers. He recommends this as a practice. But incidentally, interestingly, the prayers that he recommends in later years are what he calls the praises. He emphasizes memorizing words of joy. Mm-hmm. So there's those two aspects. He memorized the whole canon of the Mass that undoubtedly helped him in the trenches. But he wasn't just thinking about suffering. He was also thinking about joy, or at least did in later years.
Yeah. I guess it's one thing dealing with his own suffering, but how does Tolkien deal with these difficult topics like suffering, like the problem of evil, in his fiction, which is presumably how most people know Tolkien?
Well, I think there's a great realism to the suffering that he displays. And I think there's a sense that emotional suffering, mental suffering, is just as important or even harder to bear than physical suffering. I mean, if you look at the whole stretch of Frodo and Sam making their way, you know, to Mount Doom, I mean, that is agonizing. And it's agonizing not just because of their physical suffering, you know, they're thirsty, they're hungry, they're tired, they're, you know, injured, but Frodo is bearing the weight of the ring and is burning his mind away. And in fact, it ends up breaking him. And that's a really important element of that part of the Lord of the Rings. And Tolkien calls it out in some of his letters. He says that people forget that he says Frodo failed. He failed at the end. He's supposed to throw the ring in. That's the whole point. That's why they went there. And at the end, he says, I will not do this thing. And he claims the ring for himself. And I think that, and it ends up, the quest is fulfilled because Gollum bites his finger off and falls into the cracks of doom. And that, I think, really gives us a great insight into Tolkien's deeply humane understanding of suffering. And he talks about this at length in a number of his letters to different people. So it's clearly very important to him. And he says that Frodo broke, that he broke under the weight of the ring. The same way he says that some people, having been captured and tortured, they break. And of course, he would have known that this was a thing that happened in the Second World War and in the First World War. He talks about people who come out of torture praising their torturers because they have just been so crushed and broken by what they've experienced. But he says very directly that we should not judge them on that, but judge them on their intentions as they went into the suffering. And he is, why is Frodo a hero? Well, because he gave everything. He didn't hold anything back. He went into it. He gave everything he had. And it turns out that it was more than he could bear. But that's not the point. The point is that he was willing to give it all, and he did give it all. And I think that's such a deeply humane vision, that he's not imagining a sort of moral superhero, that if you're just a good enough Catholic or just a good enough Christian, you will resist all temptations. He actually says that line in the Lord's Prayer, you know, lead us not into temptation. He says that would be unmeaning if it wasn't possible for us to be tempted too far. He says there's no sense, there's no meaning in a petition against something that can't happen. And that sense that, like, yeah, we can be taken past our levels of endurance, physical, mental, spiritual, we can break. But that's not ultimately something to be held against us. That is such a humane understanding of it. And I think that partly comes out of his experience of suffering, and indeed, especially, I think, his suffering in the war and his observation, undoubtedly, of other people who probably broke in the war. And he saw this. And what a great humanity there is in that.
Do we know if there were any individuals that helped Tolkien to deal with the problem of suffering, to ease his pain in the midst of his own suffering?
Well, I think we certainly must look to Father Francis Morgan, his guardian, who would have been teaching him, you know, as a young man, and the other oratorians. I don't think we can point to any other specific figures, although, I mean, those are significant enough. But I want to make sure that we also know another part of his experience of suffering that came after the war, which I think is less noticed. You know, he came through the war with his faith intact. And indeed, Tolkien never lost his faith. He never had a moment in which he did not believe in God. But after the war, he's demobilized. He's now, you know, has his family, his wife and his children at Leeds University. He has an academic post. Everything seems to be going great. But it's during this time that he recollected later, writing to one of his sons, he said, for a long stretch, he says, I almost ceased to practice my religion. And he says that he had fell in love with the Blessed Sacrament from the beginning. And he said, by the grace of God, never fallen out again. But he says, I failed to live up to it. And he felt this starving hunger. So there's a stretch. We don't know exactly how long. He bookends it with the places that he lived, Leeds and 22 North Moor Road. So that could be anywhere from 2 or 3 years to as long as 9 years. Mm. We don't know exactly how long, but it was long enough to weigh heavily on him. And it was this period of spiritual sort of dryness for him, in which he says, I almost ceased to practice my religion. Not completely ceased, but almost ceased. What did that mean? Probably, I would imagine, meant that he didn't receive communion, probably didn't go to confession, quite likely, you know, didn't go to Mass or went to Mass irregularly. Prayer life, again, probably disrupted. Again, these are all probablys. We can imagine this sort of barrenness and sterility that led him years later to look back on that period and refer to this the sloth of that time. Which is an interesting theological word. It doesn't just mean laziness. Mm. He would have known, did know, that it refers to a specific spiritual sin of a sort of lack of interest in holy things, a lack of desire to love God. And he really pegs it. He says, I didn't live up to the love of God. So I think it's not coincidental that this happens after the war. His habits had been disrupted in the war. And indeed, one of the Catholic chaplains in these interviews said that the chaplain anticipated difficulty for the men because their habits had been so disrupted that they would find it difficult to go back into a regular routine when they were demobilized. And I think that's probably what happened to Tolkien. He made it through. But then what? Then it's all, everything is normal, but it's not normal. And I think he's trying to readjust. He's a war veteran. His health was seriously damaged by the trench fever that took him out of the front lines. He's got a lot going on. And I think that's partly reflected in this spiritual aridity that he goes through. And eventually he comes out of it. You know, there's various things that influence that. You know, his friendship with C.S. Lewis was, I think, one of them. As he helped Lewis become a Christian, his own faith is sort of revitalized. There's lots of things going on there. But I think Tolkien in later life had a great deal of wisdom about suffering because he had kind of experienced the whole gamut, including this very interior suffering. You look at him and say, what are you upset about? You've got family, you've got your wife, you've got a job, you have colleagues who respect you, you got some of your poems published. What's wrong with you, John Ronald? What's the suffering business? Very interior spiritual suffering, but very real. And he later advises in one of his sons that, you know, that it's important to just kind of persist even in times of spiritual dryness, to recognize that faith is an act of the will, not just of the emotions. And I think he learned that in a hard school. I think he learned it through his own suffering through that spiritual dry spell after the war.
And how does hope feature not only in Tolkien's own life, but also in his work? Because that does seem to be a prominent feature, that it's not just the suffering, but there is hope as well.
Yeah, I mean, his hope is fundamentally rooted in his Christian faith because he has his crucified Savior is risen. And that is the great, what he calls the great eucatastrophe, the great, you know, the good catastrophe of human history, this idea of the resurrection that changes everything. And I think fundamentally all of his writing is rooted in that experience, you know, that whole arc, you know, Good Friday to Easter Sunday, it's the whole arc. And Tolkien embraces the whole arc of it. There all is that suffering, but it's not suffering that's purposeless. It's through to Easter, through to the resurrection. And of course, his own, you know, conviction that he would see the resurrection, that, you know, all the faithful will have that new life and will be healed. So that's the hope that he's looking forward to. And that's what sustains him. And it's not a hope that's sort of light or trivial. It's a hope that's really so rooted in the whole life of faith that he's had since he was a boy, you know, that this is the reality of his faith, that there is that hope. But of course, the hope is not necessarily that things are going to be okay now, is that they will be all right. They will be redeemed. And so that's what we get, for instance, in The Lord of the Rings, the really sad and moving scene. You know, they've come back. This is in the book, because they don't have that in the films. There's the scouring in the Shire. They've put everything right. They've restored the Shire. It's flowering, and there are, you know, all these little hobbit children running around, and everything is great, except that Frodo still is distant, and he has these every year at the anniversary of his wounding in Weathertop. He has this sort of episode of you know, recollecting his suffering. And he eventually says that he has to go off to the Grey Havens. And he isn't going to live out his life in the restored Shire. And Sam is just devastated. But, you know, but Mr. Frodo, we anticipate you to live out your life here and be honored and loved. And Frodo says, yes, he says that the Shire has been saved, but not for me. And that's, I think, is a really profound statement of Tolkien's hope, his realistic hope. Because Frodo's not dying. He's going off to the West. He will be healed. There's this, you know, this understanding of that. And that, I think, corresponds with, not an allegory, remember, it's not an allegory, but it corresponds with the idea that our wounds will be healed, you know, in purgatory, and then, you know, we'll be whole in heaven. But they might not be healed in our lives. In fact, we're all going to carry wounds through to our death. Even with our sins forgiven, the wounds remain. And so we get that picture with Frodo saying, this would be lovely, but I am wounded too deeply. That healing will come, but it can't come here and now. It will come in the next life, we would say. And I think that's really at the heart of Tolkien's sense of hope. Again, that realism, it's not a kind of, oh, everything's going to be great. Love Jesus and you're going to be super. He's like, no, love Jesus and you're going to have lots of suffering and you will get through it and there will be healing. But there's that realism of the hope that recognizes the suffering along the way.
Holly, thank you so much. It's been so brilliant talking to you today.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
Don't forget that the 25th of March is Tolkien Reading Day, and we would love you to share your favourite Tolkien passages with us. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Hi, I'm Marcus Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Premier, which produces this podcast and many others. Like you, I love listening to these amazing podcasts. I also love hearing about the people who are impacted by them, like Sheila from Cheshire. Sheila's parents were both sick and she was going through a difficult time taking care of them. But she started listening to Premier's podcasts and God spoke to her through them with just the right thing she needed to hear at just the right moment. She felt reassured that God had it in hand and that her parents would be safe. It's incredible to know how important these podcasts are to so many, but they are listener funded, which means we need your support to keep them going for people like Sheila. This week, we come to the end of our financial year with our funding need yet to be met. Would you consider a donation today to help us reach more people like Sheila with hope and encouragement through our podcasts? Give your gift today at premier.plus/donate. That's premier.plus/donate. Thank you.